When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to All Rings Considered, Entertainment Weekly's podcast breaking down the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power. And we are headed into battle this week as we talk about the very eventful episode 6, which charts the fight for the Southlands. We'll be joined later by two of the people who actually fought in that battle, Morfydd Clark, who stars as Galadriel, and Tyrion Mohaddon, who plays Theo. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about everything that happens in this episode. And there is a lot to talk about, including orcs, elves, some interesting revelations, and one very explosive mountain that turns out to be a portent of doom. I'm your co-host, Devin Kogan, and as always, I am here fighting not side-by-side with an elf, but side-by-side with a friend, my co-host, Christian Holub. Christian, welcome.
Hi, Devin. It's great to be here. You know, this show has been a slow build, I think we can all agree, but I've had faith since the beginning that things were going to pay off eventually, and we start to see some of that payoff this week, so it'll be very fun to talk about. And I'm sure our listeners are coming in probably pretty pumped, probably pretty amped. So I hope to match their energy.
I am so hyped to talk about this episode because, I mean, we get a big battle. We've had a lot of, we've had a couple little skirmishes, some good action scenes. We've had lots of, dramatic conversations, some moments of humor, some moments of levity. But this is probably the most intense thing we've seen so far. And we get to have a lot of characters meet. You know, we've had all these disparate storylines, kind of spread out across Middle Earth and Numenor. And here we have, Galadriel hanging out with Arendir, hanging out with, and Halbrand meeting Theo and Bronwyn and all of these familiar faces. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of want to talk about like kind of big picture. Tell me a little bit about your reaction to this episode. Like when you sat down and watched it, what was going through your head?
Right. So I do want to do a little table setting here, which is that Amazon Studios put together a little event here in New York City earlier this week where they screened for us episode 6 and 7 coming up next week.
Jealous.
Yeah. So listeners, I know you'll all be very excited to hear, but this is the first episode where I know more than Devin because I've seen one episode in advance. And so now I get to be, the wise holder of the Ring of Air or whatever. And I know a little bit of what's coming, but don't worry, I won't spoil anything. I just want to lord it over my co-host here.
Rude.
And I don't want to brag, but it was definitely cool seeing it on the big screen because I think it's a very cinematic episode. It's, Devin, I know we talk a lot about the Battle of Helm's Deep as kind of a high watermark of fantasy battles on screen. It may be one of the best in Lord of the Rings movies itself, and also one that we kind of always think of when we watch fantasy battles on Game of Thrones or whatever. And this week kind of gives us our Helm's Deep, gives us this nighttime battle scene where the women and children have to hide in a safe place while an outnumbered defensive force tries to hold their own against orcs. Theo even kind of has his Eowyn moment where he's told to go protect the women and children and says, well, why can't I be out there on the front lines with you? And gets the comeback like, well, it's because I trust you to take care of those other ones. So, some parallels there. And I guess I have to start by applauding the tactics of Arendir and Bronwyn and their villagers. They come up with really great tactics to face Adar's superior force. And Adar also has some tricks up his sleeve and some battle tactics that he surprises them with. So, we begin with kind of the orc forces approaching the watchtower where they think that the Southlands villagers are all kind of holed up. And lo and behold, they think they just have Arendir to deal with as an Eld's archer. But the surprise is that they have rigged the tower to collapse. And boy, that's so fun and satisfying watching a bunch of orcs get crushed under a gigantic falling tower.
It's a great move. I love it. Yeah, I'm as a general rule, I am a huge fan of the trope where a ragtag crew of villagers has to band together to protect their town from invaders. I mean, this is...
Can't go wrong.
It's Seven Samurai. It's the Magnificent Seven. It's A Bug's Life. I mean, it's the best trope in the whole world. I mean, it's my favorite. I could watch it forever. And so, but I thought, you know, I thought this was a really, I loved the way this was set up. I love some of the very inventive kind of moments where it just wasn't a big battle of just like people hitting each other with swords. Like the way it was structured narratively was really fascinating. There were sort of all these ebbs and flows where you think, okay, it's going to one side. No, the other side kind of has an advantage. Oh, wait, it's the original side has a trick up their sleeve that, you know, I thought it was very well structured narratively. And I also thought we talk a lot about, you know, Helm's Deep as sort of being one of the high water marks for fantasy battles. And one of the things is, Christian has heard me yell about this a lot, just like in real life, just because it's something I care about a lot, is Helm's Deep is incredibly well lit, even though it's in the middle of nighttime, you can see what's happening. And this is a battle that is also very well lit. You can tell a story
that legacy.
Yeah, that is, you can actually see what's happening. Whereas, you know, I love Game of Thrones, but oh my God, I have to turn my brightness up on my TV every time I try to watch it because I'm just like, what's happening? Who's that?
And then that's had its influence. And it's like, I respect it, but at a certain point, like, I don't need to be totally in the dark to understand that the characters are totally in the dark, you know? Like, there's things where it's like watching Helm's Deep. I get that they're fighting at night, but I want to see all that that's happening, and there's ways to do that. So, yes, I thought of you when I was watching that, and I clocked that they were lighting it so well. And I think it's great. You can see everything that's happening. And like you said, narratively with the pacing and stuff, you also get, I think, important in battles like this, especially something that's going to take the better part of an hour. You have to mix up both kind of the macro scale fighting between armies with kind of intimate one-on-one stuff. And there's that moment kind of still in the first half of the battle, I would say, where Arendir is kind of one-on-one with this big burly orc for a little bit.
I love that.
And when he finishes eventually, you know, with Bronwyn's help kind of getting the better of him, you know, you see that it feels like the battle has been won. And basically you can take that as a stand-in for the battle as a whole, and that the battle as a whole has kind of followed the same trajectory as this duel has, in the same way, to reference a different battle from Lord of the Rings, much of the battle at the Black Gate in Return of the King is kind of shown in this one-on-one battle between Aragorn and a giant troll, and their one-on-one struggle is kind of standing in for their armies as a whole. And I think that that's, you know, you do want to see armies going at it, and we get that, but it's good to get up close with people too.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that fight between Arendir, and I wrote in my notes like mega orc. Like, I don't think he has a name, but he's just like this ginormous orc. And I like that, you know, we've seen Arendir be incredibly good at his job throughout this entire series. I mean, he's like doing flips and doing crazy stuff, but like, you really, I mean, like, this is a brutal fight. Right. Like, you see how much he's struggling. Like, he comes very close to death several times. And I was just, I love Ismael Cordova's performance throughout. You know, throughout this entire series, but I think like some of the physical and emotional things he does in this episode is just like really struck me as amazing. He's been, for me, one of the big breakout stars on a show that is filled with breakout stars.
Definitely, certainly as an action star, because his character is not particularly outspoken or anything. You really get a sense of him through his action and his fighting and in this episode, and he does a good way of conveying who this person is and what he feels about things, you know, through the way he shoots arrows and directs people in combat. And, you know, the fact that at the end of the day, he can't win without Bronwyn's help is a very Tolkien-y testament to, you know, the kind of alliances that are necessary to win the important battles. Although what I really, you know, as much as I love the fighting, what I really appreciate about this episode is what it shows us about the orcs, because Adar is not opposed to a multiracial coalition either. And so just as it seems like Arendir and Bronwyn and the Southlands villagers have won their battle, they realize that those weren't all orcs they were fighting. Some of them were humans. And in fact, they're former neighbors and people they knew who were just wearing the big skulls and stuff that these orcs adorn themselves with. I like that you're seeing the orcs that these are not the industrialized armies of Sauron and Saruman in the Third Age. This is an earlier iteration where the orcs are not into as into machines and armor and industrialization and industrial weaponry as much. They're very clad in kind of tribal aesthetics and skulls and totems and stuff, which, as we see, you know, that's cool in and of itself, but also then makes it possible to hide the identity a little bit of some of your combatants.
Yeah, that was kind of a brutal twist. Like that, like the look on the faces of some of the villagers as they like remove these masks to, and helmets to see their friends and neighbors was pretty brutal. And yeah, I mean, and I love what you said about, you know, these are not industrialized orcs. You know, these they, you know, haven't been working in the mines with Saruman and, you know, building great machinery. You know, they don't have a grand, you know, to a big battering ram to knock down the walls. But yeah, I was fascinated by this. And so we sort of see this battle goes well in some respects, but then we learn that, you know, they still have a long way to go. They still, they have not triumphed over their invaders. Fortunately, there is another group who is sailing to Middle Earth right now, heading to the Southlands. And we sort of get interspersed as this battle is happening. We get to check in a little bit with the Numenoreans as they are sailing east to the Southlands to see what's going on. I love some of these little moments. There's a great moment where Isildur gives his horse an apple and he like eats the same apple as his horse. And I was like, that's so gross, but so adorable at the same time.
Yeah.
I was like, that's extremely Aragorn to me because Aragorn's such a horse girl. like there's all these like little moments there that I was really struck by. And then finally we get the Numenoreans arrive and the tide kind of turns, which I absolutely like. What a great moment. It reminded me a lot of, you know, the Rohirrim arriving to save the day in Lord of the Rings. You know, all of the fights on horseback with the spears and things that gave me strong Rohan vibes throughout. And I loved getting to see, you know, some of these figures, you know, getting to fight as the battle turns into day. What did you make of the Numenorean cavalry?
It was awesome. You know, I was ready to cheer basically. It's a cathartic moment in the way that so many of those, as you said, because Rohan always is kind of the last minute reinforcements in Lord of the Rings. And as we've been saying, this battle is similar to Helm's Deep in a lot of ways. And that moment, especially since they're kind of coming with the dawn, is very similar to Éomer and Gandalf bringing their company in to leave Helm's Deep at the end of Two Towers, which is awesome. And I can only imagine the kind of sounds you were making every time Galadriel hung sideways off her horse to dodge an arrow.
It was so cool. It was so cool. Yeah. She's so good.
Yeah, and I love that that moment with Theo being like, who's that? And Arendir being like, that's the commander of the Northern Armies. Which, as we know, the commander of the Northern Armies is, that refers to, you know, the elves were used to be much more in the north of Middle Earth in a lost kingdom once known as Beleriand, was the elf headquarters in the days of Morgoth. And that's where their kind of power base was when they were fighting against Morgoth. So that's kind of what he means, as, you know, Lord of the Rings viewers might be more used to, you know, Lothlorien's kind of in the middle of the country, tilting towards the south. And so is Rivendell. And, you know, those kingdoms don't exist yet. As we know, Elrond and Galadriel are far from that stage of their lives. So the elves are like a northern people right now. And that's why she has that title.
Absolutely. I loved this whole sequence. I loved some of the stuff with Isildur and his father, Elendil. There's a great moment where, you know, Isildur is sort of told to hang back and he's like a bannerman, or he's, you know, he's not a squire or something like that. And eventually, you know, he's watching the fight and Muriel sort of gives him a little head nod, like, okay, go. Uh-huh. And he gets to his father, right, as his father is like almost been murdered by an orc. And he's like, oh my God, dad. And then Elendil's like, it's okay. I'm all right. I'm all right. And I was like, oh, this is no spoilers, but that's foreshadowing.
Yeah.
You know, being like, dad, I'm so glad you're okay. And you didn't die in this giant battle against orcs and the forces of evil.
Yeah.
That would be really tragic.
Hallbrand's the one who actually saves him in that moment.
Yeah, Hallbrand's the one who actually saves him. And let's talk a little bit about Hallbrand, because he
has
a
big episode for Hallbrand.
Big episode for Hallbrand. There was, I wrote in my notes, I was just like, at one point I was just like, Charlie Vickers is hot when he's taking a shower and is like,
oh, you didn't like greasy mode?
You know, when he's like a castaway on a raft and hasn't, you know, bathed in like 6 months or whatever. But I was like, oh yeah, he's like major Aragorn vibes. He's like, this is cool when he's like, you know, not using his skills to beat up random Numenoreans in the street. It's like, oh yeah, this is what he's capable of.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, what did you make of that whole, I love that whole confrontation where Adark sort of escapes and Galadriel and Halbrand essentially hunt him down.
Amazing chase scene. And actually not something that we get a ton of in Lord of the Rings. I mean, I guess it's similar to kind of the Nazgul when they rode horses in Fellowship is kind of the closest we get. Although usually it's the bad guys chasing the good guys and trying to get away. This is a little bit of a reversal where our favorites that we're cheering for are hunting down this bad guy. I thought that that was great and a very thrilling sequence. I guess it's hard to talk about without also getting into Galadriel's interrogation of Adar and the things that he tells her. So this is something I think I've kind of beaten the drum for on this show earlier. It's one of the things I was a little bit hoping for from Rings of Power is, you know, I love Tolkien. And for me, loving something means engaging kind of with the criticisms of it and or the flaws of it. And I think kind of what I would agree with that is the biggest flaw in Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's conception of it is how kind of one-dimensional the orcs are. And I think that the movie, yes, by Return of the King, the movies add a little more depth. Like you get Gothmog, that great orc general in Return of the King with the missing eye. Like you get a little personality from them. You get a little bit of, you know, you have the infighting in Two Towers between Ugluk and Grishnak and stuff. So there's a little bit of that. But I was hoping, I thought that there was a big opportunity in this show to show us what orc culture is like or what orcs want out of life. And to my delight, we finally kind of get that in this episode from Adar's own mouth. Like Arendir, he is not a particularly verbose character up till this point. You know, he said a few things and we've seen him kind of be very intimate and fatherly with some of his orcs. But we haven't gotten a mission statement from him before. And we finally do when Galadriel and Halbrand succeed in chasing him down. Don't bother to look inside the package that he was holding. I'm sure that's fine.
And, rookie move.
But they don't even know what they're looking for, too. It's true. Arendir was just like, he's got something. You can't let him get away with it. And they're like, okay. But he doesn't explain because he doesn't know. Even Arendir doesn't know. And we, the viewers, certainly don't know until the end of the episode what that object is supposed to be or do. So we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. But
they successfully chase him down. Galadriel stops Halbrand from killing him and takes it upon herself to interrogate him. And Adar gives us his mission statement. He agrees with her assessment and loyal listeners of All Rings Considered will remember Devin kind of mentioning this in earlier episodes when Adar first appeared. As she surmises and as he admits, he was one of the elves that was captured by Morgoth and tortured. You know, it's kind of interesting. I had always read that in the Silmarillion as he took these elves and turned them into orcs and that's what orcs are. But what we see here with him is that they still kind of are elves, some of them. They're just orc-like and twisted. And so Adar has taken it upon himself to be a leader for these people. And he doesn't see them as monsters or degradations of Iluvatar's creation the way that so many elves do. He sees them as his children, as people who have a place in the world and deserve a place in the world. And most shocking of all, he says when Galadriel says, I don't believe that you're working for yourself. I don't believe that you're the final authority. Where is Sauron? And Adar is talking about Sauron. And we flash back to the first episode in a scene that hasn't been mentioned much since then when she and her squad were exploring Sauron's Arctic laboratory and she saw his mark and they saw that he had been there, but there was no other sign of him except these orc skeletons and the troll that had been left behind. And Adar tells her, yes, he was experimenting on orcs. He was trying to find more knowledge. And what Adar says, and you know, the whole time in this episode, this series, as this podcast has gone on, we've had viewers online been like, where is Sauron? Who is Sauron? What's up? Where's he gone? Where is he living? And what Adar says is that Sauron is dead and I killed him. Because he was torturing too many orcs and they're my children. And he said he was just going to keep doing it. And I said, enough is enough. You can't harm my children anymore. And I cut him open and I killed him. What do you make of that, Devin?
I was like, what? Yeah. That's not what I was expecting at all. That was like a legitimate surprise.
Yeah.
And really both good. From a narrative perspective and also, you know, the look on Galadriel's face, you know, the idea that she's been chasing this evil for, you know, so much of her life. And it's, we, the reader, know that Sauron is not gone. We don't know. I have a lot of questions. Is Adar telling the truth?
It's famously hard to kill permanently, this guy, you may have heard.
Yeah, I mean, even if you chop off his hand and steal his magic ring, he can still, you know, come back later. But it's kind of a shocking reveal. And I'm curious whether Adar is telling the truth. I'm curious whether maybe he did kill Sauron and Sauron's mortal body has diminished in some way and he finds some way to return. Or, you know, and maybe Adar just believes he did. But I have so many questions, but I think it's such an interesting twist. And I think it's actually really smart storytelling from the part of the showrunners. Because you and I talked about this a little bit last week. But, you know, when the show was first announced, you know, the Second Age story is about the rise of Sauron.
We were like, where's hot Sauron?
We need our hot Sauron. And so we kind of assumed that, okay, well, the show is about Sauron. He's going to show up in the first season. You know, we're on episode 6 of 8 and he's nowhere to be found.
Right.
And here's this bombshell that not only is he, like, you know, not lurking in the shadows, but he's, you know, supposedly he's dead and Adar killed him.
He might be absent from the stage. And you know, what's kind of interesting about this is that, you know, as we've noted, you know, the show is called The Rings of Power. We haven't gotten to their forging or even the mention of their idea yet.
Nope.
Maybe we will by the end of the season. Maybe that'll be something for future seasons. But what we are seeing, as we've discussed on this show in previous episodes, is that we're seeing the reasoning build up to make the rings. Like, we are seeing the elves feel threatened, feel mortal, feel like they have to preserve themselves. For now, they think Mithril is the key to that. Eventually, they will forge their rings as the way to do that, to preserve elf life and magic and power in Middle-earth. The rings is how they will do that. And maybe this confrontation with Adar, I think you're right to say that, you know, this, you should only trust him as far as you can throw him, not least because, like, he just clearly has a different world. He sees reality differently than the other characters do, than we do. So he may be describing something in a way that's real to him that maybe does not mean what we think it means. Just, you know, just think about the other ways he talks about other stuff. Like, you know, he's not necessarily tormented by Morgoth. You know, he has a different kind of,
not the most trustworthy,
but even like just twisted in some way, you know, like the way he sees the world is maybe not the way you see the world. But I think there probably is something to, there was some kind of confrontation between them, because otherwise why would the orcs follow him if Sauron was around, or if he hadn't, you know, the orcs are a martial culture, certainly, we know, and so if they follow Adar, it's because Adar must have proved his superiority to Sauron in some way. And of course that retroactively ends a great resonance to him getting so mad at Waldreg for Waldreg thinking he's Sauron. Oh, you think I'm Sauron? I killed Sauron. You know, Sauron tortures orcs, I lift them up, you know. I love that. But this is all I was going to say. So we're seeing the elves find their reasoning for one day forging the Rings of Power. And maybe this confrontation is what inspires Sauron to come up with, well, I need a way to preserve myself if I am threatened again by powerful warriors. Or, you know, Adar was formed by Morgoth, you know, to preserve myself as the heir of Morgoth. I need some kind of way of preserving myself,
because there is a little bit of a power vacuum at this point in the Second Age, you know, after on the evil side of things, you know,
pretty much on the good side too. There's not a lot of you know, the Kingdom of Gondor isn't in existence yet, and you know, there's kind of Lindon, but it only exerts its power so far, so you know, there's a lot of power for the taking. So yeah, I think that this stuff with Adar really delivered on what I wanted from orcs, like some reasoning, some culture, and him saying that we are people of the world, and we're Iluvatar's children as much as you are, and we deserve part of the world. And then Galadriel's response to that being threatening him with genocide is, I think, enough. You know, I think Tolkien and Lord of the Rings are kind of taken for granted as black and white, good and evil are pretty clear. And I thought that this was a really interesting, and you know, the distinguished competition, Game of Thrones, is kind of the whole, whoa, good and evil aren't clear. Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? You know, this isn't Game of Thrones by any means, but like it's giving depth to the people we think of as villains, and it's showing kind of this cruel, violent side to the people we think of as heroes. Devin, is there anything you want to add on this before I put on my conspiracy hat and give you my potential reading on an aspect of this?
Ooh, I mean, I'm intrigued. But no, yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, that's something that's always been kind of something that's drawn a lot of criticism in Tolkien's work, is that for all of its nuances and for how it can be very, you know, very complicated in many of its storytelling, a lot of it does come down to, you know, sort of essential myths. You know, Tolkien was obsessed with classic myths and classic stories, right, and sort of this black and white idea of good and evil. There are orcs and goblins and trolls, and they are evil and need to be destroyed. And that's something that, you know, Tolkien reckons with more kind of morally gray situations in other ways, but that's always been a very kind of black and white reading. And so I'm so fascinated by the fact that the show is sort of diving into, you know, in some ways its view of good and evil is very earnest, is very, you know, there is an earnestness to the show that I think is kind of well-earned and I do really respect, but I also like how it's also willing to grapple with like these more complicated ideas, making, you know, the fact that Galadriel is so blind to, you know, her hatred and her, you know, single-minded purpose, that like, you know, it is this moment where she's like threatens genocide and you're a little bit like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I've been fascinated by, you know, and I think some of that ties into the response to some of these characters. You know, some people have been like, why is Galadriel so angry and so like, you know, and so single-minded and like, wow, they're like, she's such a ridiculous character. And I'm like, no, I think that's a feature, not a bug. I think that's, you know, very much intentional with how single-minded she is and how it blinds her sometimes to the reality of situations, her sort of single-minded hatred and her pain and her, you know, inability to stop this fight. So I don't know. I've just been really impressed and kind of fascinated by the way the show threads the needle between, you know, telling these very earnest kind of classic stories while also grappling with some, you know, more complicated ideas.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been told that Galadriel's the reason for her unending hatred is Sauron himself. So you would think that she would be relieved or excited to hear that he's been destroyed. And instead, she's madder than we've ever seen her, you know, like and it reminds me of, you know, what Gil-galad and Elrond were kind of saying back in the first episode, that, you know, her relentless quest after Sauron may end up strengthening him as much as hindering him. And to that point, that's an evidence point in one direction. So Sauron, you know, I obviously Lord of the Rings comes before Harry Potter, but with Harry Potter in mind, it's easy to think of the ring as a Horcrux, or that's what
very much so
Sauron wants, that he is a Maiar, and he is not a Maiar that is bound into a feeble body like the Astari are. He is incarnate in the world in his full power. And so even if you destroyed his physical, like, I guess one reading that I might be expecting at this point is that perhaps Adar is right and he harmed or destroyed Sauron physically in some way. And Sauron's spirit, not for the last time, survived that and perhaps found some kind of host that it bonded to and is living in. And here's what I'll say. Adar doesn't recognize Halbrand when Halbrand says, "Remember me." And Adar is like, "No, I have no idea who you are." And both Adar and Galadriel ask, "What did he do to you?" And Halbrand doesn't answer. We are told that Adar has harmed two people in this episode. Halbrand and Sauron are the two people that we are told by different characters that he has harmed. I have laid my theory before in previous recordings that Halbrand is my choice for Sauron. And I think my theory now is that Sauron's spirit is rebuilding its strength within Halbrand. And that is what Gil-galad and Elrond's visions mean by saying that Galadriel will strengthen Sauron because of the way that she has saved Holbrand and is empowering him and strengthening him. That is now my theory after this episode.
That is a fascinating theory, because I sort of took this episode as being like, well, that sort of disproves the Halbrand is the Sauron theory. Like, I sort of was like, well, here we see him, like, actually, you know, like, fighting on the side of good and, you know, fighting to stop everything that's happening in the Southlands. And, you know, I mean, the other reading is that, you know, when Halbrand talks about, you don't know what you took from me, like, my assumption was that it was sort of maybe a sort of a Waldreg situation where maybe he pledged his loyalty to Adar, and then like Adar forced him to, or like killed a brother or like something along those lines.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of intrigued by your theory.
Yeah.
I see no holes there. I think I'm very curious to know where it goes, because I think I agree with you that I don't know what it is, but there's something up with Halbrand. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it's going to go, but and I don't know if I mentioned this, but my theory is that maybe I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but my thought was that maybe he is corrupted in some way and he is one of the future Nazgul.
He's one of the nine, you said. I like that theory too.
I that was kind of my theory, is that, you know, maybe he does become king of these people, but then he is corrupted once they actually have the rings and forge the nine rings to give to men, and you know, he's the Witch King or you know, someone along those lines. But I'm intrigued by your theory.
And I will say, since I mentioned earlier that I've seen episode 7, this is not something that is revealed or happens in episode 7. Yeah. This is just my theory.
Pure speculation. Pure speculation. Yeah, we don't get really a Gandalf watch this episode, but
that we will get next episode.
Oh, no spoilers!
No through the Harfoots.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fascinated by this reveal, and I guess we should talk about sort of the final.
Yes, the final reveal.
The final reveal of the episode,
where we've been like, "What does this sword hilt do except be a cool sword?" And you know, it's kind of been interesting that you know, I guess it didn't really hit me till this episode, the kind of similarities between the sword hilt and the One Ring as an object clearly of malevolent power that nevertheless is tempting in some way or empowers you in some way. But you know, a ring, you know what that's for, you put it on your finger. A sword hilt, what do you do with that? Well, turns out it's a USB, basically a flash drive for a mountain.
For a specific mountain.
Yeah.
A mountain called Orodruin, which we better know as, in the common tongue, Mount Doom.
Mount Doom.
We get this reveal that not only did and you know, I'm watching this episode, and they defeat Adar, and they're sitting in the village, and, like, Muriel is having, like, this little picnic with, like, all of Bronwyn and everyone, and, like, Bronwyn's healing from her wound, and, like, it's this, like, lovely little moment, but I'm like, we still have like 15 minutes left in this episode. I don't think this is where it ends.
Oh, but I also was thinking, as maybe you were, maybe you forgot it, that right before Adar ran off, he said, "Waldreg, I have a task for you."
Yeah.
And so I was like, what happened there?
It's not over. Yeah. So Waldreg continues to be the worst character in the world. he sucks so bad. He literally uses this sword hilt to basically divert a river.
Do some terraforming.
Break a dam.
Geoengineering.
And, the river flows into this fiery underground volcano and basically causes the volcano to erupt, basically turning the Southlands into Pompeii.
Yeah.
And finally, we see Adar's plan click into place. The plan is to essentially create a barren, inhospitable wasteland that is hospitable to orcs,
yeah.
A place where it is so smoggy and cloudy and they never have to worry about the sun.
It's their Shadowland.
And it is brutal. Yeah. We see all of these flaming rocks falling down on the people as they're like having their nice little post-battle picnic outside. People screaming in terror. We see just the look of fear and realization on Galadriel's face. There's a moment where she sort of lifts her hand back to pull her sword off of her back, and then she just freezes because she's like, I've been fighting my whole life and I don't know how to fight this.
Yeah.
And it is a kind of a brutal revelation. The idea that like, oh, this is about not just about bringing, you know, we kind of thought, okay, maybe the first season is about bringing Sauron back to power. No, it's about the formation of Mordor. It is about the creation. This is a Mordor origin story.
Yeah.
A Mordor origin story.
Yeah. You know, I think kind of what's been interesting for us and for viewers of this show is we know some of the places it's going, but I could not have predicted which things were going to happen first. You know, like we know that the Rings of Power are going to be forged. We know that eventually the Last Alliance of Elves and Men is going to happen. We know that Numenor is going to sink. We know that there will be a Hot Sauron at some point. We know that the Southlands will become Mordor. These are all things we know, but it was a little harder to tell what order they were going to happen in. And
how they were going to happen,
when they were going to happen. And so Mordor is kind of coming on a little sooner than I expected, honestly. But it's a really... it's a wonderful moment, really climactic. Adar lives up to his promise to the orcs and to Galadriel that he's like, no, we deserve a place in the world and I'm going to make a place in the world for us. And I like the terraforming they do, you know, the geoengineering and astronauts on Mars or whatever, trying to create an atmosphere. Like they've created an atmosphere that's more hospitable to them. And like you were saying, this episode is so good at kind of swinging back and forth, zigzagging you. You think it's going one way, then it goes, you think the villagers are winning, then the orcs are winning, then the Numenoreans come and it seems like everything's okay, and then Mount Doom is activated and it really lives up to its name this episode. Just the falling meteors and lava crushing anyone who's unlucky to stand in the way. And I just want to mention, even before it was activated, we did have a moment of after the battle of the Numenoreans kind of riding around and celebrating their, as it would turn out, short-lived victory, that there's a moment where Isildur's talking with his friends and they're like, so what do you think of Middle Earth? What do you think of the mainland? And he's like, well, I really like the mountains. Oh, do you, Isildur? One mountain in particular? Well, one day you might see it from the inside. You might see it up close someday.
Yeah, that made me laugh a little bit. But yeah, no, I you're right. It's kind of a silly kind of fantasy plot idea, the idea of like changing the earth and terraforming the earth. But this is something that has been, you know, I was reminded of all the other times that Tolkien has written about this. Mm-hmm. You know, the story of Middle Earth and of Arda is about, you know, kind of reshaping the land. You know, we hear about you know, Morgoth raising great mountains of the Valar, you know, shaping the land. We hear about, you know, the destruction of Beleriand and things like that throughout the Silmarillion. We'll get to, you know, Numenor eventually and how that changes the shape of the geography. But it's interesting how geography has always been a big part of Tolkien's storytelling, mm-hmm. how it's not just, you know, human kingdoms or elvish kingdoms, you know, kind of strengthen or grow their borders and shrink. It's the actual topography of the land changes quite frequently throughout over thousands of years.
Right. And they're described in that language. You know, I was mentioning earlier, talking about Galadriel's title as the commander of the Northern armies. And as you point out, the elves used to be up north and they aren't anymore because their kingdom called Beleriand, it's not that it was overthrown or destroyed. It doesn't exist anymore. Like the continent was reached when the Valar came down to defeat Morgoth and manifested themselves in the world. That was a cataclysm. And we get the briefest glimpse of it back at the beginning of the first episode where you see the dragons fighting the eagles and the elves fighting the orcs and stuff. That's kind of your glimpse of the War of Wrath. And it resulted in that, in the ways that it's described by characters even long after it happened, the breaking of Thangorodrim, that Morgoth had this mountain and underground fortress that was destroyed, that was broken, that was caved in and unmade. And the thing that hasn't come up in the show or said in this term, but the Silmarillion always talks about the marring of Middle Earth by Melkor, that what Morgoth did to the world was he marred it. He changed it and cast his mark on it. And this is, you know, in some ways kind of an analog to, you know, the Garden of Eden or the Fall of Man or whatever, that the world was one way and it could have been a peaceful paradise, but the devil came down and changed it and marred it. But that's something even in the world of Tolkien kind of belongs to the world of myth and the First Age and the Silmarillion and stuff. And now we're seeing it happen in real time and clearly this is not something the characters ever expected to experience themselves.
Yeah, it's a very Tolkien idea. The idea that, you know, the shaping of geography is and the shaping of the physical earth is tied to, you know, changes in good and evil. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, the idea of creating a land inhospitable to trees and inhospitable to things right. that grow is very Tolkien. And
yeah.
I mean, what could be more Tolkien than that?
That's a great point, actually.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of, you know, when, not to cut you off, but it reminded me a little bit of, it's not a perfect analogy, but the idea of Saruman, you know, cutting down parts of the old forest, clear cutting, the area around Isengard. And this is a sort of a more extreme version of that, using a volcano instead of axes.
But in a way, it's almost more natural because the volcano exists. You didn't make the volcano. You just figured out a way to play with it or manipulate it or activate it. That is in some ways more natural because, I was going to say that this is something that we see in the Third Age and in Lord of the Rings itself, that the land is being changed. It just doesn't stick out to us as much because it's what happened in our world, you know, deforestation and industrialization and stuff. We're familiar with that from our own history. And so maybe it reads as a little less exotic than diverting a river and activating a volcano, terraforming in that way, or the reshape, taking the earth from a flat earth that you could reach heaven by sailing west and turning it into a round earth, as happens at the end of the Silmarillion. And because I've been rereading Two Towers, and literally I was just rereading the Treebeard chapter where he goes in depth on the changes that he's witnessed to the Middle Earth in his lifetime. And that, you know, he says, I could just walk and walk forever and it would never not be trees. And as crazy as Fangorn Forest seems to our heroes, it's almost like this last remnant of what was once a great forest, as it was on North America once upon a time. And where I am in New York currently was once just, you know, kind of an endless forest. So, but that stuff that we're, you know, it reads as kind of normal to us in a way that this kind of exoticism doesn't, but I see where Adar is kind of coming from, that, you know, he's just kind of using nature to his, just kind of fine tuning nature to the advantage of him and his orcs. I might be coming pro orc over the course of this recording.
You're like, they deserve to hang out in Mordor and like block out the sun.
Listen, they don't deserve to like go around killing people, but like they exist. What are you going to do? Genocide them? I'm sorry, Galadriel. I disagree with you on that point.
Let them have their little restaurants in Mordor with menus. And
eat worms or whatever. Like Timon and Pumbaa, like have their little maggoty bread store. And then they can have a, you know.
All we've eaten is maggoty bread.
For three stinking days.
For three stinking days.
Looks like meat's back on the menu, boys. They should.
Exactly.
What I would say, if I was the orc proprietor of a restaurant that just got a shipment of a horse meat or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is all Adar wants, is just to create a nice little tourist area for his orcs to open restaurants where they can go outside.
And I love it for him.
You know, he just wants to be a supportive dad.
He does.
Like, I see your dreams and we want to make this happen. Yeah. So, I think we covered all of the major plot points, and there are a lot of major plot points in this episode.
Yeah, because it's not it's a very action-y episode, you know? A lot of episodes that we cover, we kind of have to get into the niceties of what people are saying to each other or how characters are interacting. And not to say that there's not a lot of great character interaction this episode, but it's these big action beats and moments and stuff that, I think we've kind of covered the long and short of. Are there any moments that we haven't gotten to that you wanted to talk about?
I think we hit most of the things that I wanted to talk about. I just wanted to praise all of the performances in this episode. Yeah. I was really impressed by some of these little character moments kind of sprinkled throughout the action. And also the action looks fantastic. Like I was very impressed by
exciting.
You know, some of the big moments, the big scale battles, all the stuff on horseback. And another thing you and I have talked about a lot throughout this series is, you know, every time I see an orc, I'm just like, the prosthetics are just incredible. The makeup, the performances, everything there, it looks good.
And so much better than the CGI orcs of The Hobbit, where it's just like, this is nothing. Yeah. I have no attachment to this.
I mean, maybe that's why you like the orcs so much. I mean, there's sort of a gravitas to them here.
Yeah, and then just all of the as I've said, with all their skulls and cloth and kind of this kind of culture that they have now that will eventually give way to a more industrial wartime culture by the time of Lord of the Rings.
And also maybe some restaurants.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, you can hear my interviews with two of the participants in the Great Battle for the Southlands. We have Morwith Clark, who plays Galadriel, and we have Tyro Mohafadin, who plays Theo. Stay tuned. Please enjoy my interviews with Morwith Clark and with Tyro Mohafadin. Thank you so much for joining me, Morwith. I'm so excited to talk to you a little bit about episode 6, where a lot of stuff happens.
Yes, it is action-packed and lots of characters. It was so much fun.
Absolutely. I mean, take me back to, you know, when you first like got the script for this episode and kind of figured out like, okay, here's all the crazy things that I'm going to be doing. What excited you most, you know, when you first started working on this episode?
I was really excited by just kind of that I'd get to work with Ismael, Nars, Tyro, all the Southlanders. But also when you have days where there's just loads of supporting actors there, they're so exciting. And there's this like there's a slight hysteria when there's kind of 100 people all kind of creating chaos in an organized way. And yeah, so it was really exciting and it really felt like kind of that's what we were driving towards.
Yeah, because you guys have all, you know, you've been in Lindon, you've been on Numenor, you've sort of been in these little silos, and here, you know, you get all these characters who actually get to spend time together. That must be nice.
Yeah. And also, it was kind of, there's loads of stunt work. So there was also a kind of a huge stunt department. So to kind of get to meet all these people who kind of have backgrounds in kind of martial arts or circus or dance was just really amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I know you've talked about the training process before. Is there like a particular skill or like a stunt that you've learned that you're like really proud of?
I'm really proud of the two-handed sword scene. Basically, when I can use my left hand to fight, because I never thought that was possible because I've never been able to even write my name with my left hand. But also, surprisingly, one of the hardest things to do is sheath a sword.
Really?
I don't know why it's so difficult, but that will also always take the most amount of takes. And so I was always proud when that managed to actually go smoothly, because you also feel like so awkward when it doesn't work. It feels very un-Galadriel.
Yeah, I imagine that's kind of tricky because you've got the thing like on your back, and I imagine it's
or when it's down here you're just like, well, I'd have just stabbed myself in the leg there, I'd be like bleeding out.
not quite as glamorous. Absolutely.
No.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, that confrontation scene in this episode where Galadriel, you know, kind of almost interrogates Adar, you know, where she kind of learns about his history. What interested you about like the dynamic between those two figures?
I think what's really interesting about them is that, first of all, they're both ancient. So they both kind of represent Middle Earth in quite different ways, but they are kind of almost part of the landscape because they've been there so long. And in terms of what it does to Galadriel, I mean, for the person you most despise to be the person who sees you the most is just horrible. And that's what she's faced with. And I feel that this is a real turning point for her, really accepting through kind of immense discomfort that the darkness being in her is true. And that she's not a saint. And that also kind of being so one-track minded and so independent, that's when you're at your most kind of easily twistable to the darkness.
Yeah, I was struck by that moment where, you know, Galadriel talks about essentially wanting to stamp out every orc in Middle Earth. And, you know, Adar is kind of just arguing that he just wants to create a place for his children. What did you make of like that tension, you know, kind of between and that idea?
Well, it's kind of flipping her world. And I think there is something interesting about exploring kind of the elves rule over people. And there's a discomfort in that for her here. And as kind of a Lord of the Rings fan, I'm really excited that we're like seeing more about the orcs. Like, why are they the way they are? Do they think? Do they feel? Do they care about things? Can they feel sad? Can they miss people? And I feel that Galadriel is also learning all of that. Yeah, so it's a really pivotal scene. And as kind of like a fan, a really exciting one for me because lots of questions were answered.
Yeah, like that was one of the things I've been so fascinated by with this show is how it really, you know, we don't get to usually spend a lot of time with the orcs and kind of learn about, you know, what they want and who they want to be.
Yeah. And also just kind of, it's such an interesting part to play as a performer, like all the creature actors, because it is like, how human are they? Where does humanity stop? And like, how's that affect you kind of in your body and in everything you do? And yeah. It's been really interesting. And also, I feel that despite herself, she feels understood a lot by Adar.
That's not exactly like they don't, in some ways they don't have a lot in common, but in some ways they really do have a lot of in common.
Yeah, because they both have grand ideas. And I think this is the problem as well. Like they are both, he is kind of, even though he describes them as his children and stuff, he is the leader. He decides what happens. And that's also what she's doing. It makes sense to me that Galadriel, you know, she ends up in Lothlorien because to be capable of such power is so dangerous. And I think this is a real moment where she realizes how dangerous that is.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And one of the other things I've loved about these last few episodes particularly is the relationship between Galadriel and Halbrand, kind of how it's evolved, you know, from being on the raft together to, you know, kind of seeing each other in a way that they kind of understand each other. Tell me a little bit about what interested you about sort of that arc of that relationship.
I think that it's two people who really started off using each other, who then start to feel bonded to each other in a way they could never imagine. She utterly underestimated him. I mean, he's the king of the Southlands, but also he also sees her in a way that she's not prepared for. And like, he's a mere mortal. How can this be happening? And yeah, so it was really fun. And it was a really great build-up, I think, for me and Charlie to get to this scene where they're kind of utterly spent and kind of vulnerable, however vulnerable you can be as those characters, their vulnerability is laid bare. And when we were filming it, we both just felt that they couldn't possibly bear to look at each other in this moment. It would just be too much to be so seen.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, there is that tension there that's so kind of uncomfortable, but also kind of, you know, kind of fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also just working with Charlie, it's been such a joy. He is just one of the best guys. Going on that journey with him has just been wonderful. And I think kind of both of us, when we were like, they're going to the Southlands together, yay! But it also meant that we were kind of going to do this insane fight scene together with also Ismael and everyone. So it kind of felt, I feel that episode 6 was kind of a big moment for all the characters, but also all the actors.
Yeah, it's probably nice to be like, you know, you guys are co-workers and, you know, you run into each other, but you're like, oh, so this is what Ismael's been doing down in the Southland.
Yeah, exactly. Also, watching Ismael do his stunts was incredible.
Yeah, every time he's on screen, I'm like, how does he do that?
Yeah, a lot of hard work. And also, though, he like has put in lots of kind of different types of Latin American dance and stuff into his stunts. So he's really created them. They are very specific to him, and that's just kind of, it's just amazing, and it's paid off so much because it's just beautiful and means something.
That's amazing. And yeah, I mean, while we're talking about stunts, I have to ask you about the amazing training fight scene in episode 5 with the Numenoreans. Oh, yeah. Which is just so much fun. Tell me a little bit about, you know, what excited you most about, you know, bringing that to the screen.
I didn't think I was going to be able to do that at all. And I have an amazing stunt double, Rosalie Buttons, who was kind of almost in a way that was like frightening to me. She was like, I think you're going to do this by yourself. I'm not even going to do any of it. And I was kind of like, Rosie, don't say that. I can't do it. And through just these amazing teachers that I had, like, I managed to do that whole scene. However, I am doing all the kind of spinny sword stuff, but to kind of do all that kind of almost falling over that all the Numenoreans were doing is almost more tiring and demanding. Like doing those like quick stops that kind of particularly Arix Tarrant had to do when I was kind of holding a knife to his throat, that is such a skill. But also lots of the people in that scene were the stunties who had taught us how to do it. So being on set with them was just so much fun. And also watching the stunties have to pretend to not be as good at fighting as me was very funny.
That's got to be a nice, you know, kind of change of pace to be like, you know, I'm the one knocking you over this time.
Yeah, I'm going to teach you all how to do this. It was at times I was just like, oh, very exposing, but really fun.
Oh, that's so fun. And yeah, and we talked earlier this summer, and I remember you talking about, you know, the process of putting on Galadriel's armor, you know, how, you know, how much you love that kind of ritual of, you know, and what was it like, you know, walking around in a full suit of armor with a sword on your back? Like, just what's that feeling like?
Quite squeaky, to be honest. But no, it does like change the way you feel about yourself. But yeah, talking about what you're saying about the ceremony of it, you know, it would take 4 people to get that armor on. And it would sometimes make me quite emotional because I was just thinking like of all these times, you know, when all these women have dressed these men for war, taken all this care, tying up all these special bits of armor, and so many of them just wouldn't come back. I was always thinking a lot about kind of the past and history because I was playing someone who'd been alive for all of it and feeling kind of connected to kind of human history. Kind of, I felt that a lot when I was riding. That's something we've kind of done for thousands of years, like horses and humans have evolved with each other. It was really kind of profound and helped me so much with Galadriel. And I think getting into the armor was one of those. I was just like, people really did this, but the armor was much heavier.
That does make a difference. You know, it's one thing to wear the prop armor where it's hopefully you can move a little bit better.
Yeah. I don't know how they did. The chainmail was actually heavy. And I was quite glad to, there were some like incredibly tall stunties, which meant they had much more chainmail. And I was like, thank God. They're wearing like 5 extra kilograms.
A little extra weight. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm curious for you, you know, last time we talked was sort of before Comic-Con and you know, before anybody had really seen the show. What have the last couple of weeks been like for you now that the show is out in the world and you're getting to share it with people?
We're getting to share it with people, but also we're seeing it. So we're seeing it with everybody else because we only saw up to episode 3. And so it's just really exciting. And also just, I absolutely loved being in New Zealand. I was so looked after by everybody there. Like the craftsmanship and the art that went into making the show was just beyond what I could have fathomed before. And seeing it now, a year after leaving, it's been wonderful to reminisce about what went into making that and actually seeing the fruits of thousands of people's labor. And so there's a bittersweetness to it, seeing what we made. But I'm really proud, and it's lovely for it to be seen. And I've been really touched hearing that like people are watching it as like a whole family or kind of as a group of friends. I like that kind of connection can be made through it.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I cannot wait to see the rest of the season. Like after this episode, I need to see what happens next.
Yes. Well, I look forward to talking to you again. It'll be interesting to talk once it's all out.
Once it's all out. All right, great. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me, Tyra. I'm so excited to talk to you about specifically episode 6, which is so epic. There is a lot that happens in this episode. Yes. When you think back to filming this, I mean, what comes to mind the most?
I think it was a massive, massive learning curve for me as an actor. Episode 6, because it was the first time I'd ever like had to cry and on camera, and I'd never cried on camera before. And I remember I got the script maybe 6 months in advance, and I knew I'd had to cry, and I couldn't for months. And then once I just started working with Charlotte, she just kind of just knew how to get me into that spot. And then once I figured out how to get into that spot, I just was able to get there. And yeah, it really, really shaped me. It added a whole new aspect to my acting. And it was I'm really thankful for that, actually. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, because this episode is like such a big culmination of like everything we've seen so far. So I imagine it's like, it's a, you know, a bit daunting, but also kind of fun.
Oh yeah, it was very, very daunting, you know, reading the script and kind of realizing that kind of the whole episode is based around, you know, my storyline, like that whole area. It was scary because there's a lot going on with that. But we kind of all came together and just put our heads down and got working. And I'm really, really happy with what everyone's done. Well done, yeah.
Yeah. And I love, you know, the relationship that we see between Theo and Bronwyn. It's so great. And there's those great moments in you know, in this episode in particular. Tell me a little bit about, you know, working with Nazanin. What was that, you know, relationship like?
Oh, Naz and I are extremely close. We met back in December of 2019. So we've known each other for nearly 3 years. Obviously going into this project, I'd done really nothing much before this. I'd done a few short films, a few commercials, but nothing major. And obviously Naz, you know, is quite decorated, so she helped me feel comfortable on such a big set and on such something so huge, especially for me. And she just kind of taught me what it was like to be an actor and what it was like to do what we were doing, and I'm so thankful for her. And
Yeah, that's so great to have that resource, you know, on set with you.
Yeah, for sure. She actually became really close with my actual mom, which was kind of cool. So like, they would go off on their own little coffee dates, and I'd be like, can I come? But yeah.
Oh, I love that. And yeah, I mean, you talked about how this is an episode that's sort of like the culmination of the storyline with, you know, the sword hilt and everything with Theo. You know, what interested you about kind of that plot line and the fact that Theo is like so drawn to this hilt?
I think it's just, it's something so Tolkien, because it's Tolkien. Like, that is what, you know, if you know the trilogy, that it's what it's all about, being drawn to that thing. So I think it was really, really cool to kind of be that in this series. I mean, I don't turn into Smeagol or like Gollum. I don't know anything like that, but like I could kind of feel it at times, you know. So I think it was just really interesting to play with that idea of corruption and being drawn to something. And it is so, so Tolkien. And watching the trilogy and watching little interactions with that people would have with the ring, I kind of took inspiration from that and sort of put that into what it was like holding the hilt. And yeah, it was fun. It was really fun.
Yeah, I love those parallels. And I really love in this episode, there's that great scene sort of near the end where Theo and Arendir like have that conversation. And, you know, Ismael is so fantastic, like this whole episode. Tell me a little bit about, you know, working with him and what he's like on set.
Oh, love Ismael. Great guy. We've got our secret handshake. We love BTS. You'll see a lot of clips of us just doing stupid stuff on set together. But yeah, he's like a big bro on set. He like Naz, he made me feel comfortable there, and just once again showed me what it was like to be on a big set. And it, even like now, like through the tour that we just went on, he kind of would put his arm around my shoulder and be like, "Look, this is what we're doing." And it's really cool to be sharing experiences with someone so cool as Is. Yeah.
That's so cool. And I mean, yeah, I know you were pretty young when you were first cast in this. How old were you when you like officially got the job?
I was 14 with a voice probably four octaves higher and 5 inches shorter. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this has like been a significant period of your life, you know, working on this show.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big chunk of my life, because I mean it's only 3 years, but it's 14, 15, 16, 17, 4 years. Wow. So yeah, I mean, the big years of maturing have been through this show, and I think I've matured quite strangely, considering I've spent so much time with adults on film sets and not at school with friends. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, and I've got life experiences that not many people can say they have as well. So it's a real blessing to be able to talk about it and share.
That's amazing. And yeah, I'm curious for you, you know, you talked about how, you know, you've done some work before, but nothing on this scale. What was the biggest surprise, or was there anything like you weren't expecting when you, you know, first got involved in the show?
I mean, this might sound crazy, but tense. I was like, I remember going and I had my first set visit, and it was actually the scene of Miv and Charlie on the raft. And I was just going for a set visit because I was at the studio. I was like, oh, why not? And I remember walking down and I was like, what? This actually looks like a movie set. Because I've only ever seen like, you know, like photos of what a movie set looks like. Like, this is what it's like. And there's like, and there's always like tents, and there's like, you know, those chairs, the wooden chairs. Like,
yeah.
And I was like, and I saw them like in real life in front of me, and they're like tents and like cameras on cranes. And I was like, so people running around and like big racks like of costumes. And I was just like, whoa, this is real. Like, this is a real movie set. And so seeing all that was just kind of mind blowing for me, and was like such a wow moment. Yeah. I mean, it sounds so stupid, but it's so real. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Cause like everybody I've talked to is just, the scale of the show is crazy with the costumes and the production design and everybody.
Yeah. I mean, it was insane. I mean, even just like the sets that we worked on, there was kind of no imagination needed, because everything we needed to get into character was just there. Putting on the costume every day and having dirt splashed on my face was enough. But then to be completely engulfed by a whole watchtower or a whole village, or, you know, everything, it was so easy to do our jobs when we had everything right there for us. And yeah, it was really special.
Yeah, I mean, that must be, especially some of the, like, the Southland sets, like you said, are so, so beautiful, and RIP the Southlands.
Oh, yeah.
So that's so cool. And I mean, take me back to your audition process. What do you remember most about that experience?
Well, the audition process was long. Funny thing is, my brother auditioned for the exact same role.
Oh, no way.
Week before I did, yes. Yeah, so he'd gotten the audition and he did a self-tape. And then a week later, we got an email saying, oh, we want Tara to tape for it. And so I put down a tape and didn't hear back anything for a few months, and was just kind of like, oh, I guess I didn't get it. And then my agent calls, is like, oh, you got shortlisted. And I was like, no way, I got shortlisted for Lord of the Rings. Like, that's such a cool achievement. And I was happy with that. They got me to do a callback. And I remember the callback took hours. I think it was like almost 4 hours doing take after take after take. And it was quite funny because my brother was housing at the time. And so me and my mum would drive over to where my brother was at and then film the self-tape. And then we'd go home, and then Toby would call us midway on the way home and be like, the casting director said she wants you to do it again. And then I was like, oh. So we turned around and we literally did it at least 6 or 7 times. And I did that so many times. And I was like, if I don't hear back from this, like, I will be so mad because I spent so much time in this. And then didn't hear anything for a while, and I was kind of like, and then got a call again saying, guess what, Tyra, you're still shortlisted. They want you in New Zealand next week. And it happened so fast. All of a sudden I'm in New Zealand, which was crazy. And I was doing a screen test in a studio with massive green screens and real cameras and like crazy. And I was like, what? And then I came home a week later, I got a call saying I got the job. And then 2 weeks later after that, I was moving to New Zealand.
That's like, welcome to Lord of the Rings, where, you know, bring your, we're headed to New Zealand.
Yeah, it was really crazy because it was just like so slow. And then all of a sudden it was like, bang, 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 bang. And now I'm in New Zealand. Yeah.
Crazy. That's incredible. And yeah, well, I mean, what have the last couple weeks been like for you? You know, you dedicate so much of your life to the show, you know, you're making it in New Zealand, it's top secret, and now it's out and you finally get to share it with the world. What's going through your head these last couple of weeks?
I mean, I've watched every episode at least 4 or 5 times. I think I've seen the first two more than 10, because it's so crazy because I've been thinking about it for so long. Ever since I got the audition, I was thinking about what it would be like to work on this job. And then I worked on the job, and then I would think about what it was like working on the job. And then I was just thinking about what it's going to look like. And now that it's out, I just hope, I'm just thinking about what all the fans think. I watch it with my family. This is generally what happens. So I will be at school when it comes out. It'll come out at 12 p.m. when I'm at school. I'll pull it up on my phone and watch it on my phone. I won't go to whatever class I have fourth period, and I'll sit down and I'll just watch the fourth episode. And I'll be like, great. Get home, I'd watch it with my family. And then the next day I'd get all my friends together and we'd meet at someone's house and we'd watch it all together, as friends. And it was, it's really, really nice to be able to share something so close to me because it was my life, and I'm just so happy to be able to share it.
Yeah, and that's probably so nice to be able to show your friends, see, this is what I've been doing, this is what I've been up to.
I mean, I was trying to convince them for so long that I wasn't just a featured extra with two lines, and they were like, oh, Tyre, this is nothing serious. And it's like, look, I'm actually a serious character, see. And then, but they're all really, really happy for me and really proud, and I'm really grateful for them.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, I mean, congratulations on the whole thing. And thank you for taking the time to speak with me. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much.
Well, and I cannot wait to see where the rest of the season goes.
Thank you. Yeah, me too.
Our thanks to Morfydd Clark and Tyra Muhafdin for joining us. And our thanks to you for joining us as we break down this episode. If you like the podcast, please like and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have your thoughts on theories or our theories or want to tell us how wrong we are, come find us on social media. You can follow Entertainment Weekly. That's at EW on Twitter and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. And you can come find me and Christian at Devin Kogan and at CM Holub. Thanks so much for joining us. And that's it for this episode of All Rings Considered. If you liked what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials, at EW on Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at Devin Kogan and at CM Holub.
This episode of All Rings Considered is hosted by Devin Kogan and Christian Holub. Produced by Devin Kogan, Christian Holub, Chanel Johnson, Sammy Junio, Lauren Klein, and Dalton Ross. Edited by Lauren Klein. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.